Thursday, 2010.
In a planet where we're already running short of oil, where we're already running short of money, where we're already strapped for enough food for a growing population, having to deal with huge destabilizing changes in the basic physical stability of the planet may well be the kind of straw that breaks the camel's back.
That's environmental journalist and climate change activist Bill McKibben. We'll talk to him about his latest book, Earth.
The American Petroleum Institute is basically an association of oil companies, oil and gas companies, and they are the funders of a lot of these misinformation campaigns.
And that's James Hogan. We'll talk to him about the climate denial industry. His book is Climate Cover-Up. And finally, we'll hear a clip from our archives of an interview we did with George Monbiot. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The first Earth Day was celebrated in 1970 by some 20 million people in thousands of schools and communities around the nation. The idea was the brainchild of U.S. Senator Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin. He hoped that a grassroots outcry about environmental issues might push Washington to actually do something to protect the environment. Earth Day soon blossomed far beyond the capacities of Nelson's office staff to organize it. It became a full-blown social movement. And it worked. That year, grassroots environmentalists joined forces with progressive labor unions to pass landmark regulation that really did make the nation's waterways, air, and workplaces cleaner and healthier. It's a model my guest Bill McKibben is following with a movement he sparked, 350.org. The name refers to the level of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that must not be surpassed if we are to preserve the planet we're born into. But we've already blown past it. It's now close to 390 parts per million. That's already changing the planet substantially, causing hundreds of thousands of deaths worldwide, economic havoc, mass migrations, and threatening food and water supplies. In fact, Bill McKibben says, we already live on a different planet. In his new book of that title, he calls it Earth, spelled with two A's to show that, while it might look the same, we've already changed it. Bill McKibben, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's so good to be with you, as always.
Now, the title of your latest book is spelled E-A-A-R-T-H, Earth. Why did you put the extra A in the title?
Well, it's a good and natural question. And the answer is, the idea of the book, at least in part, is we really have now changed this planet. It's already a different place than the one we were born on to. It'll be more different still in decades to come, but the kind of damage that change that I was predicting 20 years ago when I wrote The End of Nature is now very real and apparent, and that means that we're going to have to start living on this new planet in new ways, learn some new habits that are appropriate to our new habitat, and hence the title.
I think a lot of people really don't get this. I find almost invariably when I talk about climate change that people are talking in terms of children and grandchildren. And my mother just the other day said, well, that's not something you're going to have to worry about.
Yeah, there's a whole riff in the beginning of the book with sort of, quote, dozens of people, famous people, talking about how climate change is a real threat to grandchildren. Would that it were so. This is happening in very real time. The Global Humanitarian Forum, the first big academic attempt to measure the effects of climate change, is estimating that already about 300,000 people around the world die each year from the effects of global warming. We see the Arctic melting at violent, rapid rate. We see big changes in hydrology, in precipitation, and in drought. The world is already warming. We've raised the temperature about 1 degree already. Unless we do things very rapidly to change our course, we're going to see the temperature rise another 4 or 5 degrees in the course of this century. This is the question for our time.
And when you say a rise of 4 or 5 degrees in our century, those of us who have been following this closely just shudder right down to our core. But for those who haven't been following it, what kind of a planet are we talking about?
A grim one. One where nothing works anywhere near as easily as we're used to. One of the points I try to make in the book is that we're already seeing big economic effects of those kind of changes. You know, where I live in the northeastern U.S., the number of storms that drop more than 2 inches of rain in a 24-hour period is up about 20% over the baseline. Those are the kind of storms that do nobody any good, that wash away infrastructure, that wash away crops, that leave insurance companies with huge problems. In a planet where we're already running short of oil, where we're already running short of money, where we're already strapped for enough food for a growing population, having to deal with huge destabilizing changes in the basic physical stability of the planet may well be the kind of straw that breaks the camel's back, at least the camel of endless growth and expansion. We're going to have to call it quits with that and figure out, I think, instead, how to relocalize and scale down our demands on the planet.
Now, when you say where you live, you live in northern Vermont.
Yes, yeah.
And you're already seeing major economic damage from climate change.
Our little town in Vermont, the town where Robert Frost spent his summers, had the summer before last, I sort of begin the book by describing that it 6 weeks apart, it had the two largest rainstorms in its history in the course of August. And they washed away half the town. You know, our road, we were cut off from the rest of the world for days. The governor had to arrive by helicopter. It took millions of dollars to patch up the one road into town. This is the sort of thing happening all around the world.
You say in your latest book, Earth, that even if we stopped emitting carbon dioxide totally right now, the climate is not going to go back to normal, not even in 100 or 200 years. How do scientists know that?
If we do everything right, I mean, and by that I mean everything, if we really, really worked hard to get ourselves off coal and gas and oil in the next couple of decades, then in about 100 years or so, the atmospheric concentration of CO2 would drop back below about 350 parts per million. It's about 390 parts per million now. And scientists tell us that 350 parts per million level, it represents some kind of safety. That's why we've run this huge global campaign the last couple of years called 350.org. But in the years between now and then, there's going to be some irreversible damage done. We don't have a plan for refreezing the ice sheets of the Arctic or refreezing the quickly melting glaciers of Greenland and the Antarctic. We're going to see sea levels go up. We're going to see the ocean. I'm staring out the window. I'm here in California today, and I'm staring out the ocean at the Pacific, a vast, wide Pacific. That water, and indeed all the seawater in the world, is about 30% more acid than it was 50 years ago, because of the carbon we've poured into the atmosphere. The atmosphere itself holds about 5% more water vapor than it did in 1970. That's an unbelievable change in a short period of time, due solely to the fact that warm air holds more water vapor than cold. As we warm the planet, it grows moister. These scale of changes aren't things we can easily turn the clock back on.
And as you say, the water is getting more acid in the ocean. That's going to affect fisheries. One of the things you talk about in the book is that there could be a perfect storm of food and water shortages by 2030. Now, that's just 20 years from now.
There are places that are very vulnerable, and there's been a lot of work in the last few years, for instance, on what happens in Africa as we see spreading drought. Africa, as always, sadly, is probably the most vulnerable continent in the very short run to increases in temperature. That's especially ironic because it's done the least to cause those increases. And the possibility and indeed the increasing certainty of really withering droughts across much of Central Africa are one of the first truly horrifying signs of what's going on.
Yeah, and at Copenhagen, people were talking about the need for the developed world to help the developing world adapt to climate change. This is one of the big issues there. But you quote an insurance company saying that climate change is going to overwhelm the adaptive capacities of even developed nations like ours. In other words, we could look like a third world nation, too.
If you keep doing enough damage year after year after year, say you get just a steady onslaught of big storms and things, among other things, at a certain point, you can no longer get insurance. Already there are homeowners along America's coasts, millions of them, who are finding that out. And without the ability to get insurance, the possibility of the kind of economy that we have is impossible. No one's willing to take that kind of risk without some way to hedge it. The world that we're building is amped up. It's not as stable as the one that we're used to. It becomes, by definition, very much more risky. And as it does, the cost of doing everything goes up.
And, you know, we're already suffering from an economic recession, a depression, really, if you talk about unemployment in many places. How are we going to be able to take care of developing nations adapting to climate change and our own?
I think that probably the answer is around the world that we're going to need to do two sort of opposite things. One is to dramatically localize our economies, to make them less vulnerable, more stable. Stop moving food thousands of miles at a clip. Start producing energy on rooftops and with wind turbines close to home. At the same time, for reasons both of practicality and of morality, we're going to need to extend some kind of helping hand, mostly in the form of these renewable technologies, to the poorest countries around the world, so that they have some chance of developing even somewhat dignified lives without burning the coal that they have on hand. That's why the fizzled talks at Copenhagen were such a sadness. That was one of the best opportunities we had to really make that grand bargain, and we didn't make it.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're celebrating Earth Day with environmental journalist and activist Bill McKibben. He started 350.org, a worldwide movement that's pushing for effective climate change legislation. You can find out more about it at writersvoice.net. Now, your name was scrawled over the top of a leaked memo. Tell us a little bit about that memo, and do you have any idea why your name was there?
I think this was one of these tempests that blew up during the Copenhagen thing. A document leaked from inside UN headquarters demonstrating that even the UN's experts knew that the negotiations that were underway were in essence a sham, that if you added up all the promises that various countries were making, you still got a world where the temperature increased 4 or 4.5 degrees, where carbon concentrations went to 700 parts per million. And whoever leaked it, I think, scrawled my name and phone number and things across the front, because this is what I'd been saying with increasing volume week after week after week. It's the most obvious problem that we face. It's why we've built this big global grassroots movement at 350.org to demand the real cry from citizens demanding that governments take note. And that demand has been loud. In October, we pulled off 5,200 simultaneous rallies in 181 countries, what CNN called the most widespread day of political action in the planet's history. That demand is loud, so far not loud enough to drown out the power of Exxon and the rest of the energy lobby, but hopefully building stronger.
We've just passed, squeaked through healthcare reform in this country, although, you know, there's some of us think it doesn't go far enough. The Obama administration countered the left's questions of it, the progressives' questions, by saying that we shouldn't make the perfect the enemy of the good. And he uses the same argument with climate policy. In fact, I think he did that at Copenhagen. Tell us what's wrong with this kind of thinking.
Well, the problem with considering climate change like other political issues, say healthcare, is that it's not quite analogous. The real conflict that's going on is not between Republicans and Democrats. It's not between the U.S. and China. It's not even really between industrialists and environmentalists. All those conflicts are real, and they need to be dealt with. But the real conflict that's happening here is at some level between human beings on the one hand and physics and chemistry on the other. And physics and chemistry, don't yield to, they're stubborn. They're unlikely to say, well, you're doing a better job than George Bush did. We got to give you that. So let's, amend the laws of nature a little bit. They're just going to do what they're going to do. And depending on how much carbon we put in the atmosphere, they'll do it. And that's why we've, I'm afraid, got to pay more attention to reality, and a little less to political reality in this case. Look, healthcare, if we don't get it right, we come back in 10 years and try again to fix it. If we wait until the permafrost in the Arctic tundra has melted and the methane, the CH4 beneath it, has escaped into the atmosphere, then there's nothing Obama or anybody else can do to rein in climate change. This is a timed test. It's different from other challenges we've faced.
Yeah, and if the methane is more powerful even than carbon dioxide, so that's one of those pernicious feedback loops.
That's right.
Talking about the politics, though, lately some people have said, well, because healthcare got passed, that's got implications for passing climate change legislation. At the same time that they're talking about cap and trade is dead, what's your read on this?
It's very hard to read what's coming out of Washington. I think the only thing we can say for certain is that if we can build a real movement, then the odds of something good happening go up. At the moment, the lobbyists are really driving the bills, and that's why they look so weak and pathetic. It's why we need to build a stronger grassroots movement. Our next big chance it may come in early fall. At 350.org, we're sponsoring what we call a global work party all over the world on the 10th of October, 10-10-10. There will be thousands and thousands of communities where people are doing things like putting up solar panels or insulating homes, not because we think we can solve climate change one solar panel at a time. We can't. The mathematics make it clear we can only solve it with legislation that changes the price of carbon. But by doing this great global work party all over the world, we want to send one message to our leaders. If we can get to work, you can get to work. If I can get up on the roof of the school with a hammer and put in a solar panel, you can get up on the floor of the Senate and do your damn job, which for 20 years you failed to do as regards climate change. That's the message we want to get across. We need a movement. Hopefully we can spur something much better than the kind of sorry collection of bills currently in front of Congress.
Okay, so what should we tell Congress to do then? Do we want carbon tax? Do we want cap and trade? Do we want cap and dividend?
The concept that people are calling cap and dividend is by far the most intriguing of the various possibilities. The bill that Senators Cantwell and Collins, Republican and Democrat, have introduced is not perfect, but it's at least interesting. It would put a cap on carbon. Exxon would have to go pay a hefty fee every year for the right to be importing carbon into the system, a cap that would go down because science shows we need to produce a lot less. The money from that fee that Exxon paid, instead of being handed over to the Congress to do something with, would instead be rebated directly to consumers. And that means that pretty much everybody would be made whole against the increase in the price of energy. Exxon's going to raise the price at the pump. That's good because it'll cause us to ask where's the bus stop around here, you know? But we can keep that from bankrupting people with this dividend process. So, you know, good for Senators Cantwell and Collins to think outside the box a little bit.
Now, the latter part of your book, I mean, the first part of your book, I think I want to ask you, you know, with the dire predictions, before we go on to some of the things that we can do about it, how do you handle this emotionally?
Being as active as I can and trying to do something about it. I think that's why I'm pleased that we're able to do this stuff at 350.org, and it's why I'm really happiest when I'm at home helping build the sort of strong local economies that we're going to need everywhere in order to deal with this sort of new world that's coming.
Okay, so a new world, a scary new world, but you also do see some reasons for hope. And one thing you talk about is the problem with the growth paradigm. I want to ask you, what about green growth? And first, I should ask you, tell us, what are you talking about when you talk about the growth paradigm?
You know, the whole point of our economy for a very long time and of our political economy, of what our government talks about, is to ever grow the economy larger. And that's for obvious reasons. You know, it's been the basic reason that we've gotten richer and life has gotten easier and so on and so forth. But we're running into strong physical limits that will keep us from continuing to do that forever, I think. One of them is peak oil and the other is climate. Both of them limit the use of fossil fuel, which has been by far the most important component of that growth economy. Without them, as we replace them with renewable energy, say, paradigms begin to shift. Instead of big centralized combustion of fossil fuels, which are BTU rich and concentrated and found in a few places, we're going to have very diffuse and scattered sources of energy like sun and wind. That makes a lot of sense to try to do close to home. Instead of being able to ship food 5,000 miles at a clip, we're going to need to grow it closer to home. That means that it's good news that farmers' markets are the fastest growing part of the food economy in America. Not only are these things good physically, environmentally, they're also, I think, good psychologically, socially. One of the things that's happened in the last 50 years as we've used ever more fossil fuel is we've become ever more kind of hyper-independent. We took as our great dream building bigger houses farther apart from each other. And one result of that has been that Americans are much less connected. The average American has half as many close friends as the average American of 50 years ago. That's a great loss. And I think one of the compensations for the trauma that we're going to undergo as we have to try to deal with this new reality is that we're likely to build stronger communities in the process.
Well, that all sounds pretty nice. But when you're talking about cutting a growth paradigm, you're talking about possibly cutting jobs, cutting prosperity. It's kind of what the right has been criticizing climate change legislation for. They're saying we can't afford this in the middle of a recession. Are you playing right into their hands?
Well, I think in the long run, you know, at some certain level, people like Rush Limbaugh understood 20 years ago that climate change was a very serious threat to their picture of what the world should be. And they're, at some level, correct about that. We can't keep having the world we have at the moment if we're going to be serious about chemistry and physics. There are ways to make that transition happen so that it's not unbelievably painful and ugly, I think. I hope the longer we put off trying to avoid it, the harder those set of choices become. But, you know, we look at things like in my state, we see the spread of this new agriculture. In fact, across the U.S., the number of farms increased over the last agricultural census for the first time in 125 years. That's good news because most of those are smaller, labor-intensive farms started by young people eager to grow food for their neighbors. That provides a lot of jobs over time. You know, we're never going to go back to 50% of America farming, but we've got less than 1% of America farming now. We have more prisoners than farmers in this country. And so as we build local food economies, we'll need people to grow local food, so on and so forth. The same with energy, the same with culture. You know, the only growing part of the music industry right now is local performance and festivals, people consuming music and the company of each other, and people relying on people, their neighbors, in essence, for culture and entertainment. These things strike me as plausible futures. What doesn't strike me as a plausible future is trying to keep doing exactly what we've been doing now that we know it's running us into a wall.
My guest is Bill McKibben, climate activist and author of numerous books, including Deep Economy, which we spoke to him about several years ago on this show. His latest book is Earth, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet. Isn't this going to take also a much more unified kind of legislative agenda? I was just reading in the paper the other day that farmers local, with the whole burgeoning local food movement, as you've just talked about it, there's a burgeoning need for local slaughterhouses, and there are not enough of them. And one reason there are not enough of them because of new rules that have been put in that basically favor the huge centralized slaughterhouses.
Absolutely. And those are just the kind of work that our legislators and congresses and governors and senators should be hard about right now, trying to put in place as cheaply as possible the infrastructure that we need in order to deal with the world that's coming. It's not going to be easy. We have let very much of that infrastructure wither, but just in the same way that we need new smart meters and new green energy grids and things, we need to do much the same work in a lot of other sectors. Food is one. You know, capital and banking is another one. We've super concentrated our financial system in a few huge New York City investment banks. That's a big problem. Not only are they too big to fail, as we found out to our great cost 2 years ago, they're also too big to be doing the kind of useful things close to home that we need banks to be doing. That's why it's good news that there are lots and lots of experiments in local currency, in local finance of all kinds. One of the good things about all this work, I think, is that it offers some hope of getting beyond the incredible partisan and ideological divisiveness that's been the hallmark of our political culture for a number of years. It's not at all clear whether a local farmers market is a conservative idea or a liberal one. It's neighborly. It exists on a kind of different political axis, I think.
You're really talking about changing the culture in a very big way, and you're also talking about not just local economies, but local action. How effective do you feel is this kind of citizen action in actually changing the culture that can create the political will to change the legislators?
Well, it's a very good question. I think that it's possible now to imagine a kind of new political architecture, and it's sort of suggested by the Internet. When we do these huge globe-spanning political things like 350.org, we're able to organize them over the net, then they happen in the real world, and then, crucially, we take the images of them and get them back up on the web, make them more than the sum of their parts. You know, people can go look at the 25,000 pictures in our Flickr account at 350.org. That sounds ephemeral and soft, but in fact, when we got to Copenhagen, on the basis of the huge momentum from this giant day of action, we were able to convince 117 of the world's nations to back this quite dramatic 350 target. That was amazing, considering that we'd only launched the campaign 18 months before and that we did it without, you know, real money or anything else. The only problem was that it was the wrong 117 nations. It was the poor and vulnerable developing nations, not the rich, powerful, addicted nations. So we've still got lots of work to do. And we're still committed to doing that work and moving ahead with some real vigor.
Bill McKibben, your latest book is Earth, E-A-A-R-T-H. I want to thank you so much for doing this work for all of us.
Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to talk with you. and a real pleasure to, you know, so many people have helped us out with this 350 work. In a way, writing Earth was a kind of way to explain what we were doing and to say thank you to people, too.
Great. Thanks so much.
God bless.
Take care, then.
Bye.
Author and activist Bill McKibben. Go to writersvoice.net to hear our interview with McKibben about his previous book, Deep Economy. You can also listen again to today's interview about his latest book, Earth, E-A-A-R-T-H, and follow a link to take McKibben's Global Warming Quote Quiz. It's a tough one. Next up, we talk with public relations expert and warrior against the climate denial industry, James Hogan. Stay tuned after the break.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life, you were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Over his 20-year career as a public relations professional, James Hogan has promoted the brands of numerous companies. He knows how words and framing influence public opinion, and how some in the public relations industry promote harmful ideas in service to the corporations that hire them. So when some scientists and so-called grassroots groups began denying that humans are causing climate change, Hogan smelled a rat. He decided to follow the money and expose what he calls the climate denier industry. He started the blog desmogblog.com and has co-authored the book Climate Cover-Up, The Crusade to Deny Global Warming. Hogan says the climate denier industry undermines democracy by manipulating public opinion through push polls, astroturf organizations, and outright lies. Our interview took place in January, the day after the Supreme Court ruled that corporations can't be banned from political spending during candidate elections for office. That's where we started our conversation. Well, James Hogan, welcome to Writer's Voice. Now, you write in Climate Cover-Up that the climate denier industry is an insult to democracy. And in the U.S., we woke up today to the news that the Supreme Court has wiped away something like 100 years of campaign finance reform in one stroke to allow corporations the same free speech rights as persons. What impact do you think that this will have on the discussion on climate?
Well, that's a sort of a chilling, you know, I read that in the New York Times this morning, and I think a chilling decision, because there's so much kind of undue influence from corporate interests on, particularly on environmental issues and climate change, where there's just hundreds of millions of dollars over the last few decades that have gone into these misinformation campaigns designed to confuse the public about climate science. And the fact that the floodgates have been opened up so that more money can go in there is not great news.
It's interesting. You say that as a science has become more certain about climate change, that the conventional wisdom has turned more to confusion and doubt. You know, in Massachusetts, we just elected one of these climate deniers, and his campaign was pushed by the so-called teabaggers, who are purported to be a grassroots phenomenon. One bankroller is Koch Industries, some of the biggest oil merchants around. Does this fit into what you talk about as an astroturf denier group?
Well, Koch Industries is certainly a funder of these groups. And there's, you know, I'm highly suspicious of any group that's getting a lot of funding from Koch Industries or the Koch Foundation, because they are funders of some of the biggest misinformation campaigns on climate science, through different kinds of front groups and different think tanks in the United States. My sense is that, you know, to go back to your earlier question, I think it's this question about lobbying. One of the issues that lobbying legislation doesn't catch, or one of the problems that lobbying legislation doesn't catch, is these astroturf groups, these fake grassroots groups. Right now, if you're a lobbyist, you have to declare who you represent. And so there's some, the public, can, if it takes time, can look and find out who's funding you quite easily. But that's not the same for these fake grassroots organizations. So you can have groups that are set up that appear to be community groups or even appear to be a group of concerned scientists, but really the group is essentially a front group for an industry interest. And we, in this our book, document two decades of the activities of these types of front groups that have declared war on climate science. That is, I think, essentially handing public policy over to the oil and gas and the coal industry.
Yeah, you talk about the role of API in this whole development of the AstroTurf climate denier organizations. Who is API and what do they do?
Well, the American Petroleum Institute is basically an association of petroleum producers, of oil companies, oil and gas companies. And they are the funders of a lot of these misinformation campaigns. There was one campaign just last summer where they set up these fake community rallies that were essentially populated by employees of oil and gas companies to give people the impression that there was some kind of grassroots uprising against the cap-and-trade legislation that was moving through Capitol Hill, looking at trying to put a price on carbon. And these campaigns were carrying this message that seniors and people in the communities where they held these fake rallies should be very, very concerned about this legislation because it was going to drive the price of heating and gas through the roof. They used essentially rigged research that was contradictory to more established research that had been done that showed that there wasn't really going to be much of an increase in the price of heating and gas. But they used these inflated figures to scare people, and they used these fake rallies to give people the impression that there was this kind of grassroots uprising. Well, they have a long history, the American Petroleum Institute, of funding and creating these groups to sow misinformation about climate science.
As you say, they, you know, they create these groups and they use kind of cooked figures. How responsible have they been for the framing around the climate debate?
They are one of a number of organizations that have caused confusion on the climate file. Another one would be the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. They would fit into the category that we talk about in our book called non-denier deniers. So they're basically, they're a group that says, yes, we realize we've got to do something about climate change. We've got to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And then they undermine any attempt to actually do something. So any kind of legislation, they oppose it. Then they also, you know, are out there, you know, calling for a Scopes-like trial on climate science. So basically creating all sorts of mischief on behalf of some of their members who are in the oil and gas industry and in the utilities industry and in the coal industry.
Aren't they supposed to also represent small businesses?
They do, and I think there's been some interesting reaction. There's some people, some organizations that have, and I'm trying to, I think it was Nike that stepped off their board. But I also think that Apple and Duke Energy and a number of other companies have protested, and I don't really actually know exactly how they did this, whether they stepped off the board or they actually stepped right off the U.S. chamber. But it has caused internal controversy, but clearly they continue down the path of creating confusion around climate change and opposing legislation.
We're speaking with James Hogan. He's the author with Richard Littlemore of Climate Cover-Up, The Crusade to Deny Global Warming. So before you mentioned scientists, there is the example of Timothy Ball. He is a climate denier, and he's a scientist. Tell us, what kind of a scientist is he really?
Well, he is he's a Canadian, retired professor who, you know, was really kind of a minor academic in a very minor university. He, you know, he didn't really publish very much and wasn't really very active in climate science. And in his retirement, decided to declare to people that he speaks to, and he speaks all over North America, that he was Canada's first climate scientist. And we spent quite a bit of time kind of looking into his background because he had such a high profile in the media across Canada and the United States, going out and saying that climate change wasn't happening. And what we found was that really he hasn't published anything on climate science for probably about 12, 15 years. And really, he wasn't really publishing anything directly in the area of climate science. It was more kind of other work and with polar bears and various other types. So maybe about four different peer-reviewed studies he'd published. But yet he was going out declaring that he was like one of the leading climate scientists in Canada, and he certainly is not. We also caught him and a group up in Canada called the Friends of Science, being less than forthright about their funding. And he basically is someone who's been used and hired by public relations firms that represent the energy industry to go across the country and do media interviews and do speeches.
Now,
and then he's denied that.
How representative do you think he is of the scientists who question global warming?
Well, we have been doing research in this area, and I just should point out, I'm a public relations person, right? So I know a lot about this area of public relations, and I kind of stumbled across this story about this public relations campaign attacking climate scientists about 4.5 years ago. And that's where our book, Climate Cover-Up, came from. And what we've been doing over those 4.5 years is looking into the funding and the qualifications of these so-called climate skeptics to see just exactly who they were and where, you know, what their motivation was. And what we've found is that it's very difficult to find a legitimate climate scientist who says climate change isn't a problem. They just aren't out there. There's a handful of them. And Tim Ball is not one of them. He's actually not doing climate science work, and he has taken money from industry. So it seems to me that if you have on one side of this so-called debate, you know, you have NASA saying that climate change is a problem, you have the National Academy of Sciences, you have the Royal Society, you have every major scientific academy in the world saying that, yes, the climate is changing, humans have something to do with it, and this is something we should be concerned about. And then you have people like Tim Ball and in the U.S., Fred Singer, who are people who have a long history of industry funding, going out saying, no, it's not a problem. Well, the one thing that they have in common is that they're not doing any climate science. And so I think people should be very, very suspicious of this kind of misinformation that comes from these people or from the groups that the Heartland Institute or Cato or these groups that they work with.
Now, as you just mentioned, you're a PR professional yourself. You have a very interesting chapter on mangling the language, which is about framing and euphemisms. And framing is something, of course, you know a lot about as a PR professional.
Yep.
Tell us about Frank Lutz and how he has shaped the so-called climate debate in the U.S.
Well, he was famous in the, I think it was 2001, 2002, for advice that he gave the Republican Party about climate change. And his research, he's a very, very skilled, very expensive language specialist. So he's a pollster who really can, you know, can come up with these just brilliant phrases that can really nudge people's thinking on issues. And so one of his memos was basically leaked and made public in 2001, 2002, that basically said, look, the public thinks that the science is not settled on global warming, that scientists are still debating it. That wasn't true, but that's what the public thought. And that because of that, you should continue to make this the doubt, the uncertainty about climate science a major part of your messages in your campaigning. So that is sort of like this famous turning point in, over this last decade. And that type of advice was taken, you know, was used by a lot of different groups, not just Republican candidates, really trying to sort of undermine this whole idea that scientific knowledge is actually growing and becoming more certain. So you have this campaign going on, and if you look at the way the media has covered climate change in North America over the last decade, what you see is the reflection of this strategy. If you look at scientific literature, there isn't that kind of a debate going on in scientific literature. This is quite settled, this science. But if you look at the way mainstream media is covering the issue, it looks like there's a kind of a raging debate. If you look at public opinion, you can see the successful impact of these strategies that people like Frank Luntz have come up with, where people now in the United States, you have numbers dropping, numbers of Americans who think that the science is solid behind climate change dropping from around 79% down to about 57%. So this stuff works, and it's an insidious undermining of public conversations and the democratic process. And I think that these people, it shocks me that they can sleep at night with this war that they've declared on legitimate climate scientists.
Yeah, and Frank Luntz is using such phrases as common sense science to frame this. Common sense, it seems quite Orwellian, actually.
Right.
But, you know, how is he using that term?
Well, let me just maybe take a step back from that question and say that, you know, people may not know what public relations people like me do. And one of the things we get hired for is for developing persuasive messages. So we might be hired by industry, or you could even be hired by your local hospital or library. But part of our job is to develop messages that nudge people this way and that way. I mean, it could be just to get you to return a book. You know, it could be to, you know, get you to do a regular health checkup, or it could be to get you to oppose legislation to fix climate change. So the way we develop messages is we use research tools, and those research tools have become very, very sophisticated. It's gone beyond just having focus groups or polling to where you have people like Frank Luntz, to highly specialized people looking very, very carefully at what it is, where the gaps are in people's thinking, and then looking for phrases that can nudge people this way or that. And there are people in this research business who are cultural anthropologists, cognitive scientists of various types, and if they're up to some mischief, they can be pushing our thinking in ways that we're not even aware of. And sometimes, on a mass level, these folks actually know more about what we're thinking than we do. So you do the research, you find out what people are thinking, and then you look for language that will push them this way or that way. So there's an example. A number of years back, there was one of these front groups that wanted to put together this advertising strategy. And they go into these small markets in the United States, and they test messages. So the message might be, who told you the earth was warming? Chicken Little? Or, you know, some say the earth is warming. Some also said the earth was flat. Or what was another one of them? You know, if the earth is warming, why is the frost line moving south?
Mm-hmm.
So they test these messages. Now, understand, the frost line was not moving south, but they weren't testing the messages for accuracy. They were testing the messages for impact. So they test this message because they know, or they have a sense that it actually might move people to say, yeah, this whole climate change thing is nonsense. And then they take that message, if it does work that way, and they put it in an ad. And they basically repeat the ad, if they've got a lot of money like these folks do, to get the public sort of shifting away from believing that what climate scientists are saying. And this has been highly effective, these public relations techniques.
So how can people inoculate themselves against this kind of manipulation of public opinion around climate denial?
Well, I think that's a very complicated question, but for me, the answer that I have for that at this point, and I'm still thinking about that, but it seems to me that it's very, very difficult to inoculate yourself against this type of thing unless you really pick up the file and you spend some time reading about climate science. So there's some great work done by the New Yorker, by Elizabeth Colbert. There's a fabulous series that I read a number of years back called The Climate of Man that people could just Google and read. And it gives you a sense of the real, what's actually going on with climate change. I think, though, that there's something else. I think we have to get in the habit, especially with these a big issue like this, of asking ourselves questions about the qualifications and the motivation behind these people who say it's not happening. The closer you look at these groups, the more you find that they really don't have the qualifications. And often, if there's not some kind of ideological, kind of extreme ideological perspective that they're coming from, they're actually on the payroll of the fossil fuel industry. And I know some people will say, we conspiracies all over the place. But the fact of the matter is that this is really an industry. It's an industry that that wants to protect massive. We're talking about a multi-billion-dollar industry. The oil and gas industry over the past couple of decades. Companies like Exxon. Exxon is one of the most successful companies in the history of companies, and many of the other oil and gas producers, oil and gas companies, are right up there with them. And so they have a lot of money to pour into protecting their interests. And there's an industry, a public relations industry, a lobbying industry, a sort of astroturfing services industry that is massive. I don't know if you've ever seen K Street in Washington, but it is a long street with buildings filled with people who are doing the kind of thing that I'm talking about.
Now, ExxonMobil and Chevron, they're underwriters for the News Hour, the PBS News Hour, and they always seem to be touting how much they're doing against climate change, how green they are, how into renewable energy.
Yeah, well, I think you start to, me, I think it's really difficult to reconcile that and their membership with the American Petroleum Institute. So I think, people, I think, over the decades have become more and more mistrustful of corporate PR and corporate advertising, and I think for good reason.
Well, James Hogan, your book, Climate Cover-Up, The Crusade to Deny Global Warming, is a really fascinating account of just exactly how this industry operates. I want to thank you so much for talking with us here.
Well, thank you.
James Hogan co-founded the Suzuki Foundation Business Council on Sustainability. He's also a trustee of the Dalai Lama Center for Peace and Education. You can find a link to his DSmog blog at writersvoice.net. Hogan co-wrote Climate Cover-Up with Richard Littlemore. We have a little time left for one of my favorite radio moments on Writer's Voice. It comes from an interview with environmental journalist George Monbiot about his 2006 book, Heat, How to Stop the Planet from Burning. The moment came at the end of the interview, where Monbiot talks about the birth of his daughter and how it led him to some thoughts about the role of love in both creating problems for Earth's climate and solutions to it.
Climate change demands a new morality. And a good example of this is what I call love miles. And love miles is the distance between you and somebody else that you love. And many people are driven to fly and to travel very long distances because of their love miles. And it is morally wrong for them not to do so, according to the old morality. The old morality says you have to fly to your sister's wedding if she's getting married in Sydney or Cape Town or Beijing or somewhere. You have to go. How could you not go? It's immoral not to go. And that's true. It is immoral not to go. But it's also now immoral to go. Climate change says it is immoral to travel. And this is, you know, very confusing, because we've got a whole different set of morality imposed upon the old morals. And we've just got to pay attention to both of them and somehow to resolve these incredibly difficult dilemmas. And what I point out in this is that the planet can be destroyed by love. It's quite easy to see how this enormous problem of love miles is creating a situation in which people are killed, and the biosphere, which sustains human beings, is destroyed through us trying to do the right thing. But then when my daughter was born, a couple of weeks before I finished the book, slightly ahead of schedule, she was 1 week ahead of schedule, I was 1 week behind schedule, and it was made for a rather difficult last couple of chapters, I was struck by a couple of things, really. First of all, that it had never really hit home to me quite what I was dealing with up to that point. I'd written this book where I had investigated the science, I'd investigated the solutions, I'd gone into great detail in doing my research, and I'd seen vast columns of data, and I'd read, 20,000-30,000 pages of material in order to try to understand what was necessary. And it had become quite abstract. This weird thing called climate change happening to this weird place called planet Earth, and we needed all these weird solutions to try to deal with it. And it became almost a board game or a computer game to trying to work out how to solve problem A with solutions B. And it didn't really hit home to me quite what it was that I was dealing with, that I was talking about 6 billion human beings here, and 6 billion human beings who included you and me and everybody I'd ever met. And then suddenly this strange little creature, this daughter of mine, was born. And you know what newborn babies are like. They're still part of the ecosystem, really. They're not quite human. They're part frog, they're part small furry animal, they're part alien being, part fairy, part pixie. They're a strange little creature groping around half blind in this new world and not knowing what to make of it, and that they don't quite belong yet to the human race. They still belong to some extent to the ecosystem. And here I was faced with this extraordinary little person sitting on my thigh as I was writing the last two chapters. And I was looking at her and I was looking at what I was writing, and suddenly it hit me with the force of a hurricane that this is what I was dealing with and that this is what I've been writing about times 6 billion. And I realized then that this wasn't an academic exercise, that this was life and death, and life and death over a vast and staggering scale, which I could scarcely get my mind around, but also life and death on a very, very small scale, and that small scale was sitting on my thigh.
George Monbiot. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to the whole interview with him. Here's wishing you a happy and hopeful Earth Day. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.